Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
Now, the fierce fighting between Israel and Hezbollah rages on as the latest Middle East crisis nears the two-week mark. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice flew into the firestorm today, beginning her diplomatic mission with an unannounced stop in Beirut. Rice met with Lebanese Prime Minister Fouad Saniora and with the Speaker of Lebanon's Parliament, Nabi Berri, an ally of the leader of Hezbollah. Alistair Lyon is special correspondent for Reuters and joins us from Beirut. Alistair, what more can you tell us about the Rice visit?
Well, it's not been an entire surprise. I mean, there was a gap in her schedule, and there was always a possibility she would stop in here before she moves on to Israel. She came in and under very tight security, as you can imagine, landed by helicopter at the embassy north of Beirut, then came in a motorcade to the Prime Minister's office downtown Beirut, and spent about 2 hours with him, which was a bit longer than we'd expected. But then she went on to meet Mr. Berri, the Parliament Speaker, and we are gathering that at that meeting she took a pretty tough line and saying there would be no ceasefire until Hezbollah unconditionally releases the two Israeli soldiers they captured at the start of this war, and until they withdraw about 20 kilometers, which is about 13 miles, away from the Israeli border. We're hearing that from a Lebanese political source. We haven't heard it from the Secretary of State herself, but that was the line she was taking, and it's not surprising because she's been saying that she doesn't just want to come here and call for an immediate ceasefire. She wants to set conditions that will lay the basis for some lasting stability in this region.
Well, not surprising, perhaps, but certainly disappointing, one would think, to the Prime Minister, at least, who's been asking her for an immediate ceasefire. Are there any other options that anyone's talking about?
Well, no. She came in and she saluted his courage and his steadfastness, but she didn't make any declaration after seeing Mr. Saniora. She did later say that she was very concerned about the humanitarian situation in Lebanon, where about 500,000 people have been displaced, and economists here are estimating the damage to Lebanon's infrastructure, roads, bridges, ports, and airports at about $1 billion so far and counting.
Given all of that, Alistair, are there any signs that Hezbollah is open to a ceasefire?
Not so far. Hezbollah are fighting on. They seem pretty confident. They claimed today that they had knocked out five Israeli tanks in border fighting. We don't know whether there's been no confirmation of that from the Israeli side, but there's certainly been some very heavy fighting right down on the border. Israelis have said they're trying to get into Bint Jebel, a town just 4 kilometers across from the border, but they're clearly meeting very fierce resistance there. There have been more Hezbollah rocket attacks into Israel today, which showed that despite these 13 days of fighting that we've had and relentless Israeli bombardment, they just haven't been able to stop Hezbollah from firing the rockets across the border. And frankly, you know, even if Hezbollah did agree to withdraw 20 kilometers from the border, which seems unlikely at the moment, their rockets still have a range to get to Israel, even from if they are pushed back.
Finally, Alistair, I wonder if you'd give us a sense of what it's like for you and the people that you see around you in Beirut right now. It's been nearly 2 weeks now of bombs and rockets going back and forth, tremendous destruction, as you reminded us a moment ago. What is it like being in Beirut today?
Hezbollah has still a lot of support amongst the Shiite population. Other Lebanese Christians and Sunnis and Druze are certainly angry at the destruction wreaked on their country by the Israeli Air Force. But they're also quite resentful of Hezbollah for starting this war, as they see it, without consulting the government, without consulting anyone else in the country. It was a decision, they say, that Hezbollah took by itself. And when this is over, there's going to be a big political reckoning between Lebanese factions who were not at harmony before, and certainly this will have made the splits widen in Lebanon.
Alistair Lyon, special correspondent for Reuters, who joined us from Beirut. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The events of the past 2 weeks have led to a number of questions about how it's come to this. Did Hezbollah, for example, have any idea that their incursion into Israel and the capture of two soldiers would escalate? Did they intend to start something on this scale, or were they surprised by Israel's reaction? And why is it happening now? Well, some believe that Iran may be manipulating some of these events as part of a larger effort to become a dominant player there. Our guest, Lawrence F. Kaplan, who is a longtime Mideast watcher and a senior editor at The New Republic, writes that is indeed how many in the Bush administration view it. Lawrence, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Gil.
Do you see this as the kind of proxy war that we saw during the Cold War years, the big powers letting the smaller powers do the fighting for them?
Well, I certainly think this is how the Bush administration views the Lebanon crisis. I think in a very real sense, the paradigm they've drawn on in response to the war is not the war on terrorism at all. It really is the proxy battles of the Cold War. I think the administration very much views the conflict between Israel and Hezbollah as a classic case of great power brinkmanship, in this case pitting the United States against Iran. In the telling of many administration officials, actually Hezbollah's provocation in a sense amounts to an opportunity for the United States really to roll back Iranian influence. And fending off calls for ceasefire, for instance, White House officials really see themselves as furthering not only Israel's interests but also America's own, because they genuinely believe that were the status quo left in place in Lebanon, were Hezbollah able to secure a ceasefire, having launched this provocation against Israel, would really amount to a tremendous victory for Tehran. And conversely, I think any settlement that confirms a rout of Hezbollah, in the administration's view, would really cut short Iran's reach and humiliate it for the entire region to see. So I guess that one way to look at that is where the Israelis and Hezbollah fighters are engaged in a local conflict. The administration and the Iranians, at least in the administration's view, are viewing this not altogether differently from the way the Americans and the Soviets viewed, for instance, the Berlin crisis or even the war in Vietnam. I think it's seen as a battlefield or a test case of brinkmanship between Iran and the United States.
And so was this a situation that was waiting to happen, and it was, could have been any number of things that set it off?
Well, I think it may have been, but, really in the administration's view, what really the pretext for this was the looming confrontation at the UN over Iran's nuclear program. And the day before Hezbollah kidnapped the Israeli soldiers, members of the Bush team will rush to tell you that, in fact, the day before there's this very tense meeting with Iranian nuclear negotiators, with UN officials, where the Iranians essentially walked out, and they believe that really with the flick of a switch, Tehran really generated this crisis and essentially gave a green light to Hezbollah to do it. And the reason they believe that the Iranians are doing this is because I think there's a view at the White House that really it's in Iran's interest to somehow conflate and confuse its nuclear program with the Arab-Israeli conflict so as to divert attention away from really its own position, which is, I think, hard to defend vis-a-vis its nuclear program.
Well, and perhaps some saber-rattling by Iran as well, or primarily, you think, a distraction? War would certainly concentrate attention elsewhere.
Well, I think it's a combination of both. I think on one level, it's the Iranians' way of saying, listen, if you're going to make life hard for us, don't pretend that we can't make it hard for you. And they have several fronts. One of them is Hezbollah, obviously, is one of their assets. Another is Syria. And I think most troubling of all is their ability to ratchet up pressure in Iraq.
And what about Hezbollah's position here? I mean, it gets funding from many sources. Is there reason to believe that it would willingly become a puppet of the Iranians?
Well, I think it's, I mean, they do. They have a verifiable return address, if you will, in Tehran and to a lesser extent in Damascus. And Hezbollah's own officials are very candid on this point. They make no attempt to hide their sponsorship from Iran or Syria. But, of course, Hezbollah has its own interests. And one of its interests, I think, is to prove to its fellow Lebanese, and Hezbollah, after all, is an indigenous force representing the Shiites in Lebanon, that it really still is a powerful actor in Lebanese politics. I think over the past few years, following Israel's withdrawal from southern Lebanon in 2000, really Hezbollah's influence had begun to diminish, particularly after Syria was ejected from Lebanon last year. And I think, in part, this is Hezbollah's way of saying, look, we're still here. We're a force to be reckoned with.
Well, and in fact, even if Hezbollah were defeated or were to vanish tomorrow, wouldn't there be another organization to rise up to take its place? Because, you know, it is, after all, also a political party. It offers civil services that the Lebanese government has either been unwilling or unable to do.
No, absolutely. I mean, Hezbollah really runs what amounts to a semi-autonomous state in the south of Lebanon, and it really speaks, I think, in the eyes of the majority of Lebanon Shiites. It is a force that really speaks for them and protects their interests in the government, and as you mentioned, it holds several seats in the parliament, and on top of that, there really, I think there's no expectation either in Israel or in Washington that the Israeli air campaign or even a ground campaign could actually rid Lebanon of Hezbollah. I think the stakes here and the aims are much more modest.
We're speaking with Lawrence F. Kaplan, senior editor at The New Republic. We're going to return to the conversation in just a moment for the disconnect that he sees in what's happening in Iraq as well. There's more coming up here and now. Continuing our conversation now with Lawrence F. Kaplan of The New Republic. Lawrence, you have also been writing about Iraq for The New Republic. You were there just recently. What is the disconnect that you saw between what U.S. politicians are saying at home and what the U.S. Army is actually doing there on the ground?
Well, I think there are several disconnects. I think in the American political imagination, Iraq is somehow an abstraction, whereas the place itself really bears little relation to the debate here at home. But in terms of the American military, I think the Army in particular, and to a lesser extent the Marines, have a deep sense of ownership about the war. As I've returned to Iraq, each year I've noticed that it really grows deeper and deeper, and to the point where really the Army has really created its own universe in Iraq, really a universe with its own values, requirements, and purposes. And I think one of the key purposes that one really does not hear much about in Washington is I think as this sense of ownership has intensified, there's a paradoxical sentiment that accompanies them among many senior officers, which is frankly they're in no rush to leave Iraq. The debate here in Washington tends to be about when will the troops come home, can there be a timetable for withdrawal, but when you talk to the troops themselves, or I should say actually the officer corps, there's a sense that, well, yes, we'd like to go home, but we only want to go home once we've accomplished our mission. And of course, in their view, the mission is really to have a stable and functional Iraq. One hears increasingly frequently in Iraq the argument from officers that if we really just had the right tools, if we had enough troops, we could win this thing. But the civilians back in Washington have deprived us of what we need to achieve victory. So I think it's a troublesome development, to say the least.
One of your recent reports, Lawrence, you wrote about a neighborhood of Baghdad where the residents come out of their houses and ask the U.S. soldiers to please stay whenever they see them out there patrolling, that without them they can't even take the trash out safely. Is that sort of I know you were an early on supporter of the war. Do you see this as the 3 years later version of the idea that Iraqis were in fact going to greet the U.S. soldiers with roses and thanks as liberators?
I guess in a sense it's a variation, if you will, of that argument, but one bred by horror rather than hope. You know, I've been seeing this for 3 years now in many different places in Iraq. As the insurgency morphs into a civil war, the role of the Americans has changed from that of a combatant to essentially really a tribe, in effect, one of among many in Iraq, and one that's perceived increasingly as a neutral arbiter, as a referee, if you will, between Sunnis and Shiites who are at one another's throats. So really what American forces spend a majority of their time doing in Iraq is reining in the local police or reining in an army unit that they spend time with, or literally manning the ramparts between Sunni and Shia neighborhoods. And I think this is not a role that this administration in particular is eager to play. This Secretary of Defense Rumsfeld has said that really it's not our role to be a buffer between Iraq's various competing sects, but I think the Army, and here we're getting back to the sense of ownership and the deep stakes it feels about Iraq, is happy to play this role because they feel they are really an integral part of the process in Iraq. And whatever they can do to move that process forward, they will do. The flip side is that when these units leave, and actually you can see this right now in western Baghdad, where the 10th Mountain Division recently departed, when these units leave, these neighborhoods literally come apart at the seams. And so you have this catch-22 that... you know, we can't stay there forever, and yet when we leave, neighborhoods and entire sectors descend into horror shows.
Lawrence, you seem much more persuaded that the Iraqi army is making progress than the Iraqi police. Why so?
The gist of the problem is that the police are drawn locally, so their allegiances tend to be with the local population, which is another way of saying that their allegiances tend to run along sectarian lines. They will be allied with Muqtada Sadr, his Mahdi army, or they'll be allied with the Sunni population. And they know if they go against the party line that their families will be killed. The army, by contrast, tends to be deployed very far from home. And the training with the army began much earlier than with the police. So the Americans really have had time to instill a certain professional ethos in the army. And the army, I think, prides itself and thinks of itself as a genuinely national, non-sectarian force. The police tend to be extremely, extremely brutal, extremely corrupt, and of questionable loyalties. And I think the Bush administration has declared 2006 to be the year of the police, but every single American officer I talked to on this past trip, they all think that the police need, at the very least, another 2 years of hand-holding before they can be effective.
Lawrence F. Kaplan is senior editor at the New Republic magazine. Lawrence, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
There's more coming up, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston.
Now, the West African nation of Liberia has two firsts. It is the first African country to elect a woman head of state. Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has been its president since November. And it is the first African country to arrest and extradite a former head of state who will be tried for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Charles Taylor, by all accounts one of Africa's most brutal dictators, faces trial at the International Court at The Hague on 11 counts, including unlawful killings, abductions, forced labor, physical and sexual violence, use of child soldiers, and looting and burning of civilian structures. What can Taylor's story tell us about Africa, and is his coming trial a turning point there? Well, here to help us answer some of those questions is Bill Berkley, author of The Graves Are Not Yet Full, Race, Tribe, and Power in the Heart of Africa. Bill, welcome to you.
Thank you.
I wonder if you'd begin by giving us just a very quick sketch of who Taylor is, a little bit about his history, which I guess we can trace his rise to power from that jailbreak in Massachusetts.
That's right. He was being held for extradition in Massachusetts on charges of embezzlement during the regime of Samuel Doe, the dictator who seized power in 1980. He escaped from the Massachusetts prison, apparently by paying bribes to guards, and after a long odyssey, started a rebellion against Samuel Doe in 1989, Christmas Eve 1989. He's an extremely cunning guy, very smart. One of the things we learned from the experience of Charles Taylor is that the people who are most responsible for the barbarism that we've seen over the last decade and a half in Africa are very smart, highly intelligent people. He was a kind of archetype for the rebel warlord in the 1990s, responsible for arming children and sending them into ruinous battle. He's particularly noteworthy for exploiting ethnic divisions. It's one of the lessons of Taylor's war that is not widely understood. I'm hoping the trial will illuminate this. That many Americans imagine ethnic divisions, so-called tribal divisions in Africa, result from some sort of ancient hatreds. It's not the case. The divisions that ruined Liberia are of very recent vintage, and they were exploited and magnified by Charles Taylor, much as we saw with Slobodan Milosevic in the former Yugoslavia. Similar dynamic. In fact, some call Charles Taylor Milosevic with diamonds, the Milosevic of West Africa with diamonds.
It's a very interesting point that you make in your book, and I also want to follow up with the fact that during the Cold War, the U.S. priorities in Africa were more about countering the communist menace and less about the welfare of individual Africans. And I wonder how much those policies might have contributed to the rise of people like Taylor.
The United States, in my opinion, bears a significant responsibility for the tragedy of Liberia. And it's important to remember not just Liberia, but Sierra Leone next door. Taylor's actually being charged for war crimes committed in Sierra Leone. The two wars interconnected. The United States has a long history in Liberia going back to early in the 19th century. Liberia was founded by freed American slaves who went on to dominate the country and exploit the country. Their descendants did for well over a century, and there are deep American roots in Liberia that particularly during the post-Second World War period thrived. Firestone operated the world's largest rubber plantation in Liberia for well over a century. And during the Cold War, particularly during the Reagan administration, the United States formed a close a client relationship with Samuel Doe, the dictator who seized power in 1980 and subsidized his regime, armed his regime, and really the seeds for the Civil War were sown during the Doe era, and particularly in the mid-1980s, a failed coup attempt, a stolen election, all of which the United States papered over and helped to legitimize. And so the divisions, the ethnic divisions that resulted particularly from a failed coup attempt and brutal reprisals in the aftermath of that coup attempt really sowed the seeds for the Civil War 5 years later. And those were the seeds that Taylor seized upon and exploited and magnified in 1989. But particularly the Reagan administration, but not just the Reagan administration, Democratic administrations as well as Republican administrations used Liberia much as they used other countries in Africa, Congo in particular, Angola, to serve American Cold War interests in competing with the Soviets and also trying to stave off Colonel Gaddafi, the Libyan leader. The United States was looking after its own interests in Africa. I spoke at length and I interviewed him for my book. Chester Crocker was the Assistant Secretary of State in the 1980s. I asked him about the depredations of the Doe era and whether or not the United States bore some measure of responsibility for those depredations. And he acknowledged that the United States backed Doe. And he acknowledged, frankly, he said to me, I wasn't looking after the interests of Liberians, I was looking after the interests of Washington. And the tragedy that ensued, in my view, is very much a consequence of that.
Well, and also there's another piece of this puzzle. In the couple of minutes that we have left, I wonder if you'd talk a little bit about the fraternity of African leaders who have been very reluctant to blow the whistle on each other. Do you think Taylor's trial, well, firstly, do you think that's changing now? And do you think that this trial does mark a turning point for Africa?
Well, you're right. That is part of the African story in post-independence Africa. African leaders unwilling to turn against each other, fearful perhaps that they themselves might come under greater scrutiny if they did so. Is this a turning point? It's part of a larger pattern of prosecutions in Africa, in Rwanda, in South Africa. The International Criminal Court, the ICC, has indicted Ugandan rebel leader Joseph Kony. A couple of Congolese militia leaders have been indicted by the International Criminal Court. Taken together with those prosecutions, I'd hesitate to go so far as to call it a turning point, but it, the prosecution of Taylor in particular, one of the most notorious warlords in Africa, brutal dictator, brutal despot, with the blood of hundreds of thousands on his hands, by itself it doesn't solve any problems, but it can illuminate the nature of these wars and begin a process of accountability, which, if followed through on over the years and decades to come, could both establish a pattern of accountability, a culture of legal accountability for war crimes, which can only serve to the good, but they can also educate the world about the nature of these wars and the nature of individual responsibility for these huge-scale crimes.
Bill Berkley, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bill Berkley is author of The Graves Are Not Yet Full, Race, Tribe, and Power in the Heart of Africa. You're listening to Here and Now. I used to think blogs would transform us into nonpartisan truth seekers. Man, was I wrong, says Matt Welch in his Farewell to War Blogging. Welch coined the phrase war blog shortly after the September 11th attacks. Welch is now an editor at the Los Angeles Times, a part of the mainstream media bloggers love to hate, and he's looking back with some nostalgia to that time of idealism when Americans came together and blogging came of age. Matt, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you with us. Part of the point that you are making in your farewell address is that bloggers, disappointingly to your mind, have turned into partisan pundits. What do you mean by that?
It's disappointing just in that I had predicted that there might be a different alternative future that's more in line with what I'm personally interested in. After September 11th, there was this gigantic explosion of current affairs weblogging that was very much inspired by September 11th, as was my own personal blog, which I started 5 days later. And in that moment in the country in general, you had Republicans and Democrats coming together. And the blogging phenomenon was very interesting because a lot of normal folks, normal citizens, getting together, describing things in a more, let's say, personal way, less kind of professionally culture war divided way. And many people were experiencing for the first time the shock of having conversations with people who they'd previously considered to be sort of ideological opponents. To give you an idea, I live in Hollywood, basically, and I tend to have blue state friends, and very soon after September 11th, you know, I was communicating with readers who were Republican cops living in the Inland Empire, you know, who would then write these long soliloquies about how they're reconsidering their opposition to gay marriage, because really the most important thing here is that we're all opposed to the people who blew us up. So there was this moment that was very exciting in which a lot of the more popular stars of this new medium were communicating with one another, and the ideal was that facts were more important than the usual partisan ideological spin.
So in essence, at the beginning it was, oh great, let's let every voice be heard, and now it's, don't confuse me with anything that doesn't fit into my preconceptions of the world.
Well, I think there still is some amount of communication that is two ways, and that has remained. You know, people are more aware of, let's say if you're a standard-issue liberal person, let alone a blogger. Like, I'll take Kevin Drum of Washington Monthly, for example, who's a terrific blogger, lives down in Irvine. He's going to read and be aware of what the right is thinking, what Republicans are thinking, what right-wing bloggers are thinking, more than he ever probably did before. Something about that, I think, is permanent. That being said, people have created their own little cores of beliefs, and you see right now interesting splits and fissures even among those camps. I mean, the Joe Lieberman primary race in Connecticut is a prime example where lefty bloggers are really banging the drum for his opponent, Ned Lamont, and other constellations of both bloggers and media people see this as a big direct threat. It's kind of a schism on the left. On the right, you see this big schism between people who to this day are very stubbornly in favor of the war on terror no matter what, and they're actually referring to their former ideological cohort as the 180s, as in they turned 180 degrees around and now are, you know, just as biggest appeasers as the awful lefties that we were all yelling about 5 years ago.
Well, certainly we have become more partisan as a country, more deeply divided than we have been in the past. How much, if any of that, would you chalk up to blogging?
Blogs, I think, just do accelerate societal trends that were already there. And societally, from, I don't know, 1996 on, maybe 1994 on, depending on when you start your date, we have become more binarily partisan in a certain way, more kind of professionally, this is this group, this is that group. And so I just think that's a normal thing that's happening anyways in our politics, and blogs allow for that to be even more unfiltered and give it an extra turbocharge. But I don't think blogs themselves are like this partisan-making machine. As a matter of fact, by the mere act of the hyperlink, where you can link to your opponent's arguments, you are having much more of a conversation than traditional politics.
Matt Welch, assistant editorial page editor, Los Angeles Times. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You can go to our website to find links to some of Matt Welch's favorite blogs, here-now.org. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. Martina Navratilova has announced that this is her final season of professional tennis. Really? In 1975, Navratilova defected from her native Czechoslovakia. She went on to win the four major tennis tournaments multiple times, including 20 Wimbledon titles. And with her 50th birthday approaching, she has decided it might be time to pursue a life off the court. Recently, Navratilova was in Harvard Square in Cambridge, Massachusetts, promoting her book, Shape Yourself, My Six-Step Diet and Fitness Plan to Achieve the Best Shape of Your Life. She sat down with Bill Littlefield, who hosts the NPR program Only a Game, to talk about why this retirement, which is her second, she first retired in 1994, will be for good. Bill began by asking why she decided to write a self-help book.
Well, I sort of didn't have a choice. I was asked so many times, how come I can still play tennis? How come I can still run so fast? How come I look so good without any surgeries? And I realized I knew a lot more about the subject than I thought, and I thought I should really put it down on paper so I can share the pitfalls and what I've learned, the good and the bad, and pass it on.
So the process of discovering that you knew more than you thought you did is just over the years discovering what you have
Absolutely.
To do to keep churning along.
Absolutely. I mean, I've really been taking really good care of my body since 1981. For the last 25 years, I've been really doing all the good things for it. Of course, I have some privileges that come with being a professional athlete and having a lot of money, but still a great majority of what I do can be done by anyone at any level, financially or economically, and lifestyle-wise. It's all doable. So I just really wanted to for people sort of to give them the guide of how they can make those changes to help their own lifestyle, because I think most of us just look on the outside, we don't look on the inside enough, and this book is more of a comprehensive look at your life and what you like, what you don't like, what you can change now, what you can perhaps change later, and how to implement those changes.
It's interesting to me that you pinpoint 1981. Was there a conscious decision? Did you look around and say, wow, if I'm going to continue to compete at this level, I better start taking care of myself? Did something happen to provoke that recognition?
Well, what happened was that I realized I didn't have forever as far as an athlete, because I always figured I would play till I'm 30 years old, and then I'd probably do something else. And my time was running out. I was 26, and I hadn't really achieved things that I wanted to achieve in my career, and I really wanted to get better. And in order to do that, I had to sort of take care of everything, not just the tennis part, but off the court part as well, which of course included eating properly. I didn't need to lose any weight. I weighed the same since, about 145 pounds. I'm about 150 now. But for the last 20 years of my career, I weighed the same. I just needed for it to be better quality. So I got into nutrition and, of course, more cross-training, working out with weights and playing basketball, running on track, and then implementing a coach. So I sort of had a team of people that really helped me get myself together.
It's very interesting to me that you have that sort of, you had that sort of recognition when you were 26. I haven't accomplished what I would like to accomplish, and I may not have all the time in the world to do it. Was there a point in your career where it suddenly occurred to you that if you applied yourself and worked as hard as you possibly could, you might be the very best female tennis player who ever lived? Did that sort of dawn on you at some point?
No. At that point, it was that time in 81 when I just thought, okay, my time's running out, so I better get my act in order here. But how far that was going to take me, I didn't know. I just knew I needed to do it right then and there. You don't decide to be the greatest of all time, because that takes a long time. And that's not anything you can control, because first of all, it's a subjective thing anyway. And second of all, you need huge time longevity for that.
You certainly have achieved.
Yeah, I have, but you can't control that. I mean, I could have been in a car accident or just, blow out my knee that was never going to heal. Stepped funny, broken a tibia, and there goes my career. So a lot of luck goes into that, but I also think you make your own luck, and the fact that I'm still in such great shape is not an accident. It is because of everything that I've done. So longevity is a product of working at it for a long period of time. You can't just sort of do something right for a year and think that's going to carry you the rest of your life.
Is it scary to anticipate life without tennis at the top competitive level? Is that
no, not at all. It's very exciting. If it was scary, I would still be playing. I never play tennis out of fear. I play tennis because I love it, and I'm stopping to play because I love my life away from the tennis court, and I want to pursue that a lot further than I have been able to, particularly in my private life, but also my business opportunities.
It just strikes me that to be a top athlete in any sport, whether a team sport or tennis or whatever it might be, the level of commitment is so extraordinary, not only to staying in shape, but I mean just the number of hours you have to spend practicing, the number of hours working on the psychology of having yourself at the top of your game every time you play is so extraordinary, such a commitment that to get beyond that, it must be kind of a kind of curious sensation of knowing, well, I'm not going to be thinking of myself as a pro tennis player any longer.
Well, the commitment is so strong that it really takes over your life. It's not just about the time you spend on the tennis court or training and all that, but it's also not even going out to dinner when you want to go out to dinner because you need to save your energy for the next day. If that's what you want to do, that's fine. But I'm at the point in my life where I don't want to do that anymore. I want to spend more time with my one and only. And I want to be able to go to the movies when I want to go to the movies, not when I possibly can. I mean, this year I've been so busy, I think I've gone to the movies 3 times, you know. So that's not the life that I want, and that's my favorite thing to do with my honey. So I am not scared at all or worried about what retirement will bring, because first of all, it's not retirement. I just won't be playing tennis.
It's only retirement from tennis, but
absolutely,
there's lots of other things to look forward to.
Lots of things to do. I'm promoting the book. I really want to spread the word and have people get the idea that they can also have better quality of life. And I also have a rainbow card, which I co-founded 10 years ago, which is a credit card that raises money for the gay and lesbian organizations around the country through its work with the Rainbow Endowment. So I'm very active with that. I want to take it international, going into Canada this summer, and hopefully going to Europe next year, and really want to help make a difference in the gay and lesbian community. So I'll be very busy.
Yeah. You're going to have your hands full.
I'll have my hands full,
absolutely,
to say the least.
Now, just one last question. Do you anticipate, now that you are retiring, getting cards and letters from the various women against whom you played when you were in your 20s and your 30s saying, hey, it's about time, you know?
Well, the ones that are playing, like, for example, at Wimbledon, we have the 35 and over for women, and I saw one of the players, and she's about 5 years younger than I am. She says, well, when you're 60, maybe you can play with us. Because I'm really pushing the boundaries when it comes to age. I mean, in these Grand Slams, we have the 35 and over for women and 35 and 45 and over for men. You know, I get so many compliments from them, and that's what really makes me realize how special it is what I'm doing, because these are men and women who have had, like, hip replacements, you know, and knee replacements, and you know, they're sort of walking around with a limp, and they just can't believe what I'm doing. So that's what makes me feel good, that I'm doing something right. And again, that's why I sort of was forced into writing that book.
Kind of fun to push boundaries.
Yes, it is. I question authority. Definitely do. And then when somebody says do something, and I'm like, well, why? You know, is this a good thing or a bad thing? I always question it, and that's why I got in trouble in Czechoslovakia. That's why I get in trouble in the United States. You know, I criticize what I don't like, or I speak up for what I think is right and what I think is wrong. And so I always push those boundaries, and I suppose I always will.
Tennis legend Martina Navratilova speaking with Only a Game host Bill Littlefield. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Gail Harris. Join us next time for the news.